those chairs. I bought chairs for up there, and pulling them out, there was four in a box. So I don't know if it was lifting the boxes up, or pulling, trying to pull the chairs out, or I don't know. But I'm sore in my arms, I'm sore in my... And I'm thinking, I must be needing more exercise because I'm sore. But I was. I still am. I told my sister-in-law, my arms hurt. And I was sore when I got home. I drove home because I thought if I was too late, I was going to go to my brother's house. But three others came in and helped, and so it went pretty fast. And we had to take out the old and take those out so that the people I've got lined up to take them off could get to them, and then set up the new. So, but they called me today after Bible study, and they said, oh, these are so nice. Exactly. When we talked about it in Sunday school here, it's like, oh, this feels so much better. But they had been talking about getting new chairs for a long time, and they didn't do anything. I got to fix that Bible, because, I mean, the hymnal, because it's backwards. I don't know, it doesn't mean anything to anybody but me, but I like to have them all in a row, my ducks in a row.
They have a name for that.
CD. Or ADHD.
Or both.
Or both.
Hello.
Hey, Gayla.
Or both. That's even worse.
My son just brought me coffee. He's whether he likes it or not.
She was talking, Carly was wondering how we get all this, the entire Renaissance group up here.
No, I'll just wait.
And I said, well, you'd be surprised.
If you go to sleep,
we take everything down. And they bring their own sound equipment, too.
Oh, really? Will we have to remove the pulpit and everything?
Oh, yeah.
So when are we going to try to set that up? After Easter, I know, but I mean...
Yeah, probably Saturday before, yeah.
Is there a designated committee that does
no.
that?
Alex. So when you look around for people who are young, healthy,
well,
and strong.
Well, there's going to be 100 young, healthy, strong people here. in fact,
is that what they did last time?
They probably did. They kind of helped themselves to everything. They even, one of the main tech guy went into the circuit breaker box.
Oh, that's right.
And he actually added a circuit just for the audio equipment.
Really?
And ran it out to have a dedicated line because they push a few watts through.
I do remember that, man.
Yeah.
It's a busy hour or two before church starts. We're talking
about
the last time.
Well, they came the day before, I think.
Did they do that?
Yeah.
But I think they're coming the same morning.
Okay.
Renaissance.
Is the concert?
It is frantic. Is it not? Right beforehand, get everything ready to go. I have a problem with the O-ring, I do believe, because I'm leaking.
Probably was wondering how you fit 100 people in there.
It is a lot of moving very fast. Have you seen Renaissance before?
No, I'm excited about it. That's what I was saying. I'd love to see what it looks like, other than how much work it's going to take to get room enough up there for 100 people. I mean,
well, the good news is it's about 100 college students.
Helping hands.
And they have done it so many times at that point that they can change a room in about 10 minutes.
Do they change it back?
Yeah. They unload and unpack and everything. The chairs will be gone, and the thing will be gone, and it'll all be gone, and you'll wonder how in the world it happened.
And they go to much smaller churches than this.
Much. Much. Hmm. They're gonna be in Lebanon at night, I think, Lebanon City.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you.
I am too. I made a mess, excuse me.
So I, last time they were here, I made a video of them, fast forward. So I set the cameras up to do snapshots on motion, and then I put it all together to make a video. And I'm sure it's still on the webpage, but you see them just running around like crazy in the course of like 5 minutes, it all happens.
They're pros. Matthew plays for, the guy that leads them plays for the Gaithers.
Oh, really?
And listening to him play is just, no human being should be able to hit that many notes in that short period of time. It is unreal. So I can't wait for him to be, lay himself set together. Did y'all know Rob was a musician?
No.
I found out tonight he plays guitar and piano and all kinds of stuff. I had no idea. Like, used to play like real music.
Wow.
Had no clue. So I found out today.
Huh.
So you find out more about that?
Yes, exactly.
Let's pray. God, thank you for today. Thank you for sunshine. If it had not been sunshine, we'd be thanking you for the rain. Thank you, God, for the time together. And if we had time alone, we'd thank you for that too. So we just thank you, God, that today gets to be the day where we do your thing. And right now we're going to study. We're going to think our way through our faith and hope to come out the other side with a faith that can more authentically shine your light. We ask this in your name. God's people said.
Amen.
Ooh, which question? That brings up another question. Why do we look at this? Why does this matter? Why does church history matter? Why does anybody care about church history? Like, is it just interesting? Is that, I mean, interesting.
Well, it is interesting.
It is to me.
It is to me. But I think it's helpful to know more about the history of the church because it helps us put more into perspective of where we are compared to, I think, no.
Mm-hmm. You hope so? Yeah, that's fair. So I guess that brings up the second question then. How do you see faith and culture? We always hear people, I hear people hear it all the time, oh, they're just letting culture get in their faith. It's always a kind of a blame thing. Nobody's ever like, man, you're really letting culture get in your faith today, right? Nobody ever says it like this. Always, you're letting culture get in your faith. How do you see culture and faith existing together? What is your kind of thought? I didn't wrestle with this one for like 3 days. What's your kind of thought about how do faith and culture exist?
We have this saying in the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, reformed and always reforming. And I think to an extent that is adapting to the culture. Martin Luther, you know, he discovered Romans for the first time. But
no, I knew about Romans.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think God does that at different points in history. Things that maybe weren't that important before. Culture evolves to a certain point. Maybe technology, like the printing press, evolves to a certain point. And then there's this progressive revelation that happens. And not anything new is sitting there in the Bible all along, but suddenly our eyes are opened. This has application to us today. And I mean, I think we have to realize that God was the author of the Bible, and while he wrote it during Bible times, he knew we would be reading it this century. He knew other people would be reading it 500 years from now. And I think he's put things in there for us, for all generations. I mean, I think you can go too far and let culture into the faith, you know, too much.
What do you mean by that? When you say the culture, like, what do you mean by that? Maybe.
Well, I heard an illustration of a family who started a ministry to troubled teens, and that's a good thing if you can continue to be steadfast and point in the right direction and stay in the right direction yourself, but you can kind of go down the path with them. I mean, so anyway, I think that's, you want to avoid that. I mean, like, addicts are the best people to minister to other addicts, but there's always that danger that they're around users and they go down that path. And
culture in that sense is temptation.
Yeah.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
I got you. This is very providential look at I would have not thought of. Wonderfully interesting. The idea of culture almost pulling forward parts of scripture that were laid for us in the past. Very providential look at the writing of, right? I'm going to put this here for a date in which it is needed, or in whatever manner. I don't think it's the only way you kind of worded that, but that's an interesting take. Yeah. When you think of culture, and that's a really interesting culture and faith. What are you thinking in that?
Well, so one thing that occurs to me as we're talking about it.
I hope y'all have just fantastic conversations sometimes at home, by the way. I just need you to know that. Like, sometimes at home, I hope it's just like mind bending. Otherwise, y'all have wasted a marriage. But go ahead. At least in my eyes. Not yours, but mine.
Is that for the Jewish people, faith was culture. Their religion was their culture.
Okay.
Then when the Messiah comes and there's a whole new thing going to the nations that they're told, now they're taking a part of their faith that they've had all along, go back to the original Jews, the first Christians, they're having to go and into different cultures with the culture that they grew up in, and a changed faith, a faith that is now has a Messiah, has fulfilled the prophecies that were there all along. So Christianity has a whole new thing of going into new cultures and sharing the good news.
And then that becomes the breadth of what culture can be, right? Like, literally anything can change.
Right.
And you're walking. Okay, I'm with you. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
I was just thinking on those lines. Oh, So what? Then we have the United States, where we are. And which is different than all the other countries and their histories, but primarily Christians founded this country.
Of some variety and sorts.
All
varieties and sorts.
Yeah.
Which is what we'll get to tonight. That's
right,
the interesting part.
Right.
Yeah.
And brought a European, Christian, European, white culture here and started a country based on that. Yet, we have invited all of these, over the years, we have all these other cultures coming here, immigrating here and forming the United States. And the Christians are now once again having to go into the nations, but they're staying home.
and a lot of missionaries coming from other countries here. You have missionaries from other countries that come to the States.
So there's there's a whole lot of faith and culture interchange going on around the world.
Lots.
A whole lot.
Which answers a little bit of a question of post culture. you can see culture, that top-down thing, culture is what it's given to, right? But also culture exists in just who we are. That is the culture. And so who I am very much becomes an expression of my faith. It can't, they're inextricably tied at that point. Yeah. Other thoughts before we kind of dive into this? Your idea of culture and faith.
Don't you think it was really hard for the disciples to go out, and Paul, because they had to really be strong. I was watching the show about ancient civilizations, and it said about Corinth. And the island of Corinth was not what I expected it to be, how they explained it. And so for Paul, knowing how hard it was for the Corinthians to live in that culture and to be strong in their faith, really made such an imprint in my head that culture is not always an easy thing to live with in your faith.
Right, and there we go back again to culture as understanding as sort of temptation.
Right.
Right, that exists somehow also separately from. It's a, to me, culture and faith are a little bit like that old analogy of the oil at Olive Garden that got the really garlicky. Mm-hmm. The garlic and the oil are two different things.
Yes.
Right? Two very different things. When they are pressed upon each other, they become togetherness in a real way that you, it's hard to separate. You can't separate them. You can identify them. That's the oil part. That's the, but it's really difficult to pull them apart. And I think to a large degree, that's what we're talking about. But then we get into the other little understanding of sometimes it's the other adulterants mixed into it as well, right? So that's kind of, we're struggling with some of these ideas about what culture is. Yeah, go ahead.
The Bible verse that came to my mind was Paul in sharing the gospel. He says, "For though I am free with respect to all," this is 1 Corinthians 9. 19.
That's New Testament.
Yeah. For though I am free with respect to all, I have made myself a slave to all so that I might win more of them. To the Jews, I became a Jew in order to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law.
Shoot pull.
Yep. No, I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law. And it goes on. To the weak, I became weak so that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people that I might by all means save some. And
that doesn't mean he was playing to people. That literally means he's making a connection, right? That's Paul's understanding of the faith. How do I connect with people on such a level that we have a togetherness, right? Mm-hmm. That's not fake in the least to me. I think it's absolutely beautiful. It's the same thing as eat with the people, I mean, celebrate with people who are celebrating, and cry with those who are crying. Connect with them, be in this thing. That's the part of the culture, right? What happens if we move the faith from a communal, monastic, the king tells everybody who they are going to worship, not because necessarily trying to demand allegiance, which sometimes is the case, but let's say I'm a king and I believe in God, and there are heretics out there, and I am the trusted of the faith to govern these people and to lead them in the right way, and there are heretics out there, you best bet I'm getting rid of them. Protecting my people. Done with might and power. It goes from that to Nolensville. Now go to Franklin Pike, it's even better.
It is.
Drive up Franklin Pike from Concord Road to Nashville. Just choose your church.
It is.
Just choose
I did it years ago.
Pick a church. an individual faith versus this communal faith. That is a massive change. And it happened in about 250, 300 years. Just like that in a blink of time. That becomes a huge culture change in how people live the faith out. We're going to continue walking through this, which means we got to, there's so many dynamics in this shift over in, at the time of the Reformation that we got to go back again a little bit and play through it. But this culture change from feudalism to democracy, from the Holy Roman Empire to local ruler. You know, Luther thought he was going to get rid of this, these people lording over you. All he did was create 100 of them. But it got to the point where people were able to express their faith in their vernacular, in their culture, in their way. This is the transition that happens to the faith. And I'll argue it is just as insane of a transition as Jew to Gentile. It's that huge, I think, to me. So let's look at it. Prior to Luther, we talked about it last week, is Jan Hus and the Hussites in Prague, Czechoslovakia. And they were the ones who started, not the first, but were rebelling against Rome. They wanted to have the bread and the wine. What was a big one? We're talking about the bread. The minute I learned something this week, y'all blew my mind. And so, as that existed, there was the I forget what year it was, but there was the agreement between the Hussites and Rome that whoever the king chooses to worship, that's how we worship. So if it's in the Hussite area and they want to do it this way, if it's in our area and they in our king, then that's the way we're going to do it. And that's what happened eventually to the Reformation. So in 1520, you had that same thing happen eventually, whatever it was when they had the agreement that whatever king owned that area decided if they were Protestant, they were Catholic, they were whatever. And that is a massive shift from what had been since 300 something, a little bit afterwards, yeah. Two big consequences of that. No longer was Europe unified, and there became a massive culture change. Another thing that leads us into the Reformation in the United States, because I want to get to the United States, how do we get to where we are? The thing that led there was, in medieval times, magic was still a thing. And salvation was not a personal response. Salvation was participating in the local faith church community. And it was through the sacraments. You were given grace to this mediator, the pastor, the priest of the area, the bishop. And in that sacrament was birth to death. That you were given grace. So everything, the weekly participation in penance, in Eucharist, in confession, all of these things that were happening were faith-based. You lived your faith through the rituals of the faith. And you just existed in the faith. There was no... The conversion experience wasn't a thing. This is a communal way of living out the faith. Now, that being said, there were those times of conversion. I'm not saying that people decided they were going to follow the faith. But the understanding was that you were part of the community of faith. It wasn't an individual... Nobody asked what church you went to. Everybody knew what church you went to. You went to one of the kings they went to. Right? That's how the faith was understood. In the midst of that... They believed in magic, really. I hope I took this down. Please tell me I did. I don't know if I did. Don't worry, so I'll have to go back and read them and bring them out. But in the they would do a couple of things. So The first one was that devotion wasn't intellectual. It was bodied. It was through fasting. It was through praying. It was through doing the rites. It was doing the rosary. It was a participation effort. And the other things they did was they would do things like blessing fields. There's this story about, I thought I had written it down. It makes me so sad I didn't. Account of they would go into the fields in this one certain area and they would put honey and like 6 or 10 different things on it, on the field. And then they would have 4 times of Eucharist over it. And that was the blessing of the field to have it produce. Then there were other things that they, if you were found to have gone to fortune tellers, or if you lost something and you wanted to find it back and you went to them, that you had to do the fasting a certain extra amount of times. And these, because there was a great concern in the Middle Ages, people who were, in the New Testament, in the Old Testament too, were participating with people who are, the, you know, magicians. And so that was one issue. And so you had exorcism, you had these sacramental objects that people would go to and pray over and expect healing, and all of this spiritualized faith existed among just the people, right? They would go to the shrines. There was Mary's shrines everywhere. There's one in France where apparently Charlemagne's grandson may have either stolen or received a shroud or a veil that was Mary's veil, supposedly. It's mentioned a few times in scripture, and it's in his church in France. You can still go see it. There was a church in, there's a place in England that a guy like 1050 something, he had a vision. He was supposed to replicate Mary's house in Nazareth, the house. So I think you can still see parts of it in England. There was another one somewhere. I forget where the third one was. But you had these places that you went to that were these Mary shrines. And all of this was a participation in the faith. As part of it, you had a couple of guys that started sects, they're the Dominicans and the Franciscans, that specifically showed a path to faith that existed in community and in poverty and in preaching and in participation. So y'all heard of St. Francis of Assisi. You've heard of him. He was born 1182, 1226. He was wealthy when he was born. He was born to a bunch of money in Assisi, Italy. Merchant family. They were cloth traders. As a kid, he was all into luxury, all into partying, having a good time. Life was great. And he didn't show any really religious interest at all. He ended up going to war. I forget where it was. I don't know if I wrote it down or not. He was captured for a year. Got sick, in the midst of it, had really like, I don't think I'm going the right way about life. No kidding. So he had this mystical experience when he goes home, and he hears Christ saying, "Rebuild my church." He thinks it means his home church. So he goes and does like any person, and he goes sells all of daddy's stuff to get the money. And starts rebuilding the church. Not what dad meant, or not what God meant at all. Dad was not happy. In the midst of it, he renunciated his wealth. And before the bishop, stripped all of his fine clothes off and renounced his inheritance right there in front of the bishop. He goes and he founds a group called, anybody got their Bible with them? Anybody got it handy? Somebody look up Mark 8. 834, 9:3 from Luke, and I'll read the first. If you got Luke 9:3, if you got Mark 8:34, we're good.
Okay, I got 9:3.
Either way, so he goes into the church, and he and some guys who started kind of following him in his visions, they just flip open the Bible 3 times. Now it's amazing they hit the gospel 3 times. Shocking, I know. God works in mysterious ways, right? But the first was Matthew 19:21. If you want to be perfect, go sell what you possess and give it to the poor and come and follow me. Sorry, rich man, right? Rich ruler. Mm-hmm. Luke 9 says,
take nothing for your journey, no staff, no bag, no food, nor money, not even an extra tunic. Whatever house you enter, stay there and leave from there.
You're good. So take nothing with you, right? That was the second one he read. 8:34.
He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me.
So he drafts some rules. Now you have the Franciscan Order of Monks. That's who that becomes. We got a papal approval from Pope Innocent III. Everybody calls himself Innocent. And he thought that he would see St. Francis, you know, rebuild the church. What he found him doing was walking across Italy barefoot preaching. Absolute, complete and utter poverty. And he celebrated the nature of God's creation, a famous addressing every creature in the world as, anybody know this? It doesn't matter what it was, brother and sister. Which I just think is cool. Be a brother, that's a brother. I just think that's the best thing ever.
A blessing of the animals or something, isn't
that? That's where that's from. Yep. That's one of the places where. He met enemies unarmed, advocating peace and Christian. I mean, the guy was just insane, right? So about a year before he died, he was somewhere at a retreat, and all of a sudden he started bleeding of his hands and his side. And he got developed wounds that for the next year never healed, but bled, never decayed, but bled. And it was the result of what they call stigmata. And his argument was that it was the greatest of all blessings to have the pain of any kind of moment in life. Now, why in the world would that be a blessing? How could you call it a blessing to be in abject pain?
Take up your cross and follow me.
There is no greater love than this. To lay down one's life. The physical act of suffering gave him a joyful spirit, and therefore he devoted himself to poverty and prayer. There's a great story surrounding him. But that was one of the heads of the faith, is this guy, right? The other one was Dominic. He founded the Order of the Preachers. He wanted to fight off some heresies. This came from, again, from a good education. This is the Dominicans. Received a solid education in liberal arts and theology. Was a priest at a cathedral. And then he encountered some heresy in 1203 while traveling, observed the spread of some other beliefs. And he realized that the people who were practicing this poverty were gaining some really popular respect, and he didn't understand why. And then he realized how lax and wealthy the church had become, and he recognized why they were getting so popular, even in what some believed it was a heresy. So he started the order. The Dominicans, and again confirmed the order and endorsed their mission to preach. And he decided that it was going to be a life of relying on alms rather than having any property whatsoever. And so everywhere you go, you beg, and you beg for your existence, and preach, and beg, and preach, and beg, and preach. And so all these people start following, right? Because this is the popular understanding of what it is to be a person of faith in this culture. This idea of going in, a leper. Like, this is what it means to be. You're in community with this. And so all these people started joining him, but it becomes really hard to run an institution when everybody's going to be begging all the time for money, right? So something interesting happens. They start raising money and having an institution. Because how do you do your job otherwise? I can't go out. We all can't go on the street corners all the time. We got work to do, which is legitimate. And so this becomes places of houses where they would do in these different orders, they would do religious training. They became the preachers who went out and preaching this news. And it's interesting that they dedicated prayer, dedicated contemplation, always preaching. They wouldn't shut up about preaching. It was more important than prayer and all kinds of other stuff in their list. Preaching was an act of devotional reflection. That's something that's continued today. I have argued since day one, if I can't convict me on about Thursday, I'm not convicting anybody on Sunday. Like, it has to be a reflection of what I'm trying to, you know, what we're all trying to deal with.
But is that just because you're a pastor? Or is that supposed to be for all of us? Mm-hmm.
Well, Luther would argue the priests are all believers, right? That we're all, if I'm going to talk to somebody else about a struggle, I better be convicting here first.
I fail then really badly.
We all have.
Because.
One of us, congratulations. Well, cool kids.
Carlene, preach the gospel always when necessary, use words.
There you go.
Oh, well, then maybe I've not been failing so bad.
Yeah.
But this is an understanding of, as I'm living this out, if that's what we're talking about, like, not everybody's preaching, right? Not everybody joined this sect. Other people were doing other things.
True.
But if we're going to take the analogy, one of the understandings is, if I'm going to go do burrito ministry, I got to recognize what poverty is. I've got to participate in it. Something's got to be convicted in me before I can go out and tell somebody why I'm doing it for them, right?
But isn't that God moving in your heart, whether you've been starving before or not? I mean, doesn't He lay that on your heart that there's a need?
We hope.
Well.
Right.
I don't know why.
But that's their understanding. Is there in their world, they're saying their preaching was a participation in. It wasn't exhortation. It was part of the unveiling of God, right? It became even more important. I'm discovering who God is through preaching. And preachers, I would hope all preachers would say the same thing. So I'm getting at it. Yeah. That's the only part, really, the point I was making in that. So anyway, my point is this is emblematic of what it meant to be base level popular Christian. It wasn't the kings, they were imposing it. It wasn't necessarily the bishops, it's good to be a bishop, but it was this understanding of what it meant to be faith. And it was communal, and it was magic, and it was participatory, and it wasn't this real conversion story, as much as even these two existed somewhat in that. 1265 through 1321, Dante was alive. We'll call it the medieval time. He wrote the Divine Comedies, Purgatory, Hell, and Heaven. And in doing so, he was the bridge between, in many ways, the medieval age and all the mysticism and spirituality and all that kind of stuff. And the Renaissance, which was coming, which was very, we're going to pull back the classics, right? But we're also going to do our language. We're going to try to make the Bible in our language. We're going to write these books in the translation in our language. It's going to be very important for in a few minutes. So he wrote Dante's work, and it sort of slid between these two areas. It was deeply involved in the medieval worldview. It was picturing God's justice and grace in this big cosmic battle. You know, this is all this kind of stuff, if you're familiar with it. But on the other hand, was really praised human potential. Keep these things in mind. This was the bridge between the two. This kind of world sort of slowly changed between the two. It became less rural, more urban, more wealthy, more scholarship and education, more stuff, more trade, more ideas. And this starts growing in the West. And one of the important, to just kind of understand a little bit what happened, like from the 900s to like the 1200s, they had really good weather in Europe. Like it was really warm, a lot of rain, and the crops were great. And so for a time, we know that the West was like kind of lower socially than the East. Well, they had a huge population boom in Europe. That's good. Because people were making a lot of stuff, there's a lot of food, and people are getting wealthy now because they got a lot of food, and there's really good weather. And what happens when there's a population boom? You just had one, you get a pandemic. Happens every time. Get too many people together, they get sick. You get people too close to animals, and this, that, and the other, and what happens? What's that?
The plague.
You get the Black Plague. Somewhere around a third of Europe died.
What
in 4 years.
When?
1350, I haven't written down, 13...
I heard the Black Plague, but I couldn't remember when it was.
It was 1352, no, 1347 through 1351. 30% of Europe died in 4 years. Should have worn masks. The joke. But the important part is, the cities had really started ramping up going into the Black Plague. Things were looking like there was money flowing. There was a little proto middle class. There wasn't much yet. There's a little bit there. There's still aristocrats. They're still tied into the, you know, but it was rising up. Black Plague hits all falls apart, right? We know how that works. But just like the church, we've experienced the last couple of years, there was a growth back. Because people still needed, there was a lot of land to be farmed. And there weren't as many workers. So now you have a prince who's got an area. Okay, back up. You know about the gift economy versus a commerce economy? Are you familiar with this? This is so weird. The way it worked prior to commerce, it's called a gift economy, more or less. Alex is the king. Congratulations. Does it feel good to be the king?
It's good to be the king.
Alex is the king. We're all peasants. Sorry, y'all. Well, we grow food. And Alex is a good guy. He's a good dude. Like, he's not out to hurt anybody. He just wants me to have a good place and this, that, and the other. So he our land, we all farm our land, a little plus that we have. He owns it. We're farming it. And it's our, and you know, land we've been living forever. And when we have all the green beans come in, you know what we want to do? We want to give some. There's no price tag on it, right? No price tag on that. We just know we need to gift the king part of what we got because he gave us the land, whatever, right? And in return, there's a bridge that we really need to have to go across that river. And the king is so kind. You know what the king does to the people that bring him those green beans? He builds them a bridge because that's what kings do. Now, there's no price tag on either one of those. It's a gift economy. You just do these things as a participation of whatever, right? Now, you have a whole bunch of land that has now been cleared, needs to be farmed. You're now using the three-crop rotation. You got harnesses for your oxen so they're not getting choked at the neck, and you have bigger teams. You're doing more, and you need to farm this land. And there's not even workers. Suddenly, it's no longer a gift economy. It's, I'll pay you $4 when that guy will pay you $3. And we start seeing the first hints of a commerce that becomes that starts happening. Put a price tag on things. Now, it existed before. It's not like that it never existed. But that's sort of how some transition starts happening in this time period. The agriculture stuff changes, and there became a drawing back of the history of philosophy. And now everybody's using their own language, and the printing press hits. And all those schools that the Dominicans had started, and that had started in churches for preachers, are now open the doors to people who are in a secular education. More, somewhat. This is a drift, remember, it didn't happen overnight. But you start getting an educated group of people, right? And you start getting middle class. And you now have smaller nation states where the king chooses for that group what they get to believe. But now here in a minute we're going to find that we have more splits that start happening. And so it becomes less of what area you live in and what king you are with determines how and when you worship. But who do I choose to worship? Who do I choose to follow? What group do I choose to be with? Changes that dynamic drastically of how it meant to live the faith. Imagine the difference of there being one church in Nolensville, and because you live in Nolensville, you go to that church because that is who you have been chosen to be your direct representative to God. Versus, and by the way, Catholics can choose where they want to go. Don't think they somewhat, like, it's not like that with the Catholic Church anymore either. Or don't go. Or choosing one of 50 churches in town where there's 7,000 that are online. all during the week. How's that change your faith? And that's going to take a second. But how can you see that would change your understanding of the faith?
It's a freedom, you know, because it used to be a control thing. I mean, whether the king decided which way or not, it was his decision, so that was not your choice. You just followed whatever he wanted you to do. But when there's more choices, then it's the freedom for you to find what's comfortable to you or whatever you believe in or whatever you want to say that. Don't you think that that's some of that? Because up until that point, they might not have had that choice.
Ooh, okay, there you go. How about this? We'll make it very visceral then. They wouldn't ever ask you just now. You've never been asked. Here's your wafer. Thank you. The huge difference then, how do you see that? Right? All the difference in the world. There's not the room for questions. Right? It doesn't really exist as much. Education is going up. One of the big things at the time was the middle class, upwardly middle class, and funded rich, funded universities, supported the arts, supported the sciences, all this was happening. I guess this might be best seen, this transition from the community to the individual in Michelangelo. If you look at any of his art, the human body becomes so important. The symmetry of we've seen this, the power of the human body, David, that sculpture becomes, it becomes such a focus on the person in a lot of the potential of human, I guess you could say, in the art, and it leaves that community, the poverty behind. And suddenly we have in the arts especially, you see a transition from what it means to be an impoverished servant of God to an empowered servant of God. And all of these things are shifting at the same time in the faith, making it look wholly different. Ooh, that's gorgeous. Look at that on the back wall. Wow.
Oh, yeah. It's coming.
Yeah. I don't even know where I am with this. I'm just talking.
But the Jews still believe in a community, don't they?
They all do somewhat.
Well, I mean,
but the focus of the faith becomes the Jewish people. It is community, right?
Right.
We will say the community here. That's the hope, but it's on an individual transformation versus being plugged into and just living it out through rites and rituals and traditions.
And so the appearance of different churches and faith, that it leaves it open to heresy all over the place. That's it. And when people get to, and you get to choose what you want to believe.
Which I have heard
scary.
Some of the craziest stuff that people have come to me about internet preachers, y'all. Some insane thing I heard the other day. I'm like, well, why did you listen?
I know.
I mean, like, some of the craziest stuff. Because there's not that communal check and balance on, right? That's why we have elders. That's why we have presbyters. That's why Calvin designed it in such that he did. Maybe. Except we all believe something different anyway.
But you know, people don't believe.
From the other side,
yeah.
Do you think that, like, it changed churches. Now they're trying to attract people instead of you can come to. This is how we do it, and you can come if you want to. We need to change with.
So how do you change? That comes your heresy again. What do people want?
Yeah.
Culture. Mm-hmm. So we can blame that on people again. It gets it very messy, doesn't it? It gets it really messy. We call it freedom of choice. What it is really messy because it's freedom of choice.
It's very American and individualist. I don't know what it's like in Europe. The
Very small signs on churches anywhere else except in the South. Let me just say it that way. Very small signs normally.
You mean?
So let's talk about it. Let's go to Europe real quick and do exactly that. So one of the first to come around was a guy named Zwingli. I love that guy's name, Zwingli.
Swiss?
He was much more radical than Luther on the sacramental issues. Luther broke and said, it's still that stuff. And Zwingli was like, nah, it's bread and wine, dude. It's a little bit less than that. It's get over it. By the way, the whole magical stuff, do you know why? Are you ready for this? Do you know why? And in the Catholic Church, the wafer is placed on the tongue. So good. Any clue?
No challenge.
Remember, it's magic world. It's a magic world. And so don't put your hands out, put your tongue out. Think about a psychiatric institution. If they know a patient doesn't take that medication, they put it on the tongue and make them watch them swallow it, right? You might take that bread home and put it in a concoction or in an amulet.
And it's been blessed and everything already, right?
There was a real difference in black magic and white magic. Mm-hmm. The understandings of the two. And if I can take that and do something with it, the priest's like, no, open your mouth. That's what it boiled down to. Is that not just, like, I triple check as I'm reading, I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Hold on. Go ahead. Do it because it became part of a rite and tradition. Nobody's gonna take that thing anymore. Mm-hmm. But became something that we do because, again, changed the meaning of culture, the touching and the blessing of. It's never what it was. Isn't it crazy?
Wouldn't have thought that. I was thinking maybe it's so you wouldn't contaminate it by touching it or something. But
so you couldn't take it and put it in the love potion later on.
Well, why don't they? The Catholics do the wine.
That's safe for the priest. And that was what the Hussites were so angry at. We want both of them.
Well, that's, but yeah. why was it only good for the priest?
I don't know the exact reason. I should look that up. So I looked that up.
Because I'm curious why that was, I mean, it's supposed to be, Jesus said, this right. is the body and the blood.
Well, they believed that it was the actual body, and therefore, the blood was included in.
I don't know why
they told.
Yeah, that sounds as reasonable anything I could ever come up with.
Research.
So the.
I think I missed this.
In the Catholic faith, they would. This changed after Vatican II, right? Did they change this? I think it changed. I don't know. But anyway, they would give at the time the bread, but the priest drink the wine. The lady never got the wine, and that was what one thing the Hussites and Jan Hus was so upset about. They wanted both of them. We shouldn't be restricted from that. There shouldn't be an intermediary. But there's something in an intermediary thing in that is the reason that they don't.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean this to get.
No. It's exactly. No, that's what we're. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about. Yeah. I can't wait to know this. I got three people looking it up. It's not the same.
Oh, good grief. That Christ is fully present in both the bread and the wine.
So it became a tradition.
So receiving either is sufficient to receive the fullness of the sacrament.
Hmm. Cool.
And receiving only the host can simplify distribution.
I'll leave the rest of that jug of wine for me later on, please. We don't need to give to them. So we got Luther out there, and he kind of sides with the princes in the first when he splits off. The princes sided with him because they saw a power in this. They could split from Rome, and they knew it. And so they fall into the Protestant faith. The people then believe the Protestant faith. He gets into guys like Zwingli because Zwingli doesn't think the peasants should have been massacred in. Luther wrote a book on how to do it. I mean, like literally on why. Yeah, they should be massacred. 100,000 peasants died in that revolt. So you start having these splits that begin happening. What time am I like way late already?
It's 6:55.
Yeah, we're good. Because I'm having Zwingli starts on a process of he died in battle, by the way. They were fighting over this stuff and he died. So he goes into the kind of the Dutch Reformed Church area of the world. We have John Calvin in Geneva at the time, also in Switzerland, that he starts digging in on predestination. We're going to recover some of what this stuff is later. But he starts really hitting on predestination because he says not so much as a hair falls out of your head that God didn't ordain. And so everything is God ordained as well. How would God not ordain everything that happens? God made it, right? And so God's sovereignty, church governed by elders, all this stuff's happening. And because you start having a middle class being built up, it starts becoming people who are sort of plugged into the social network of a town. A lot of laws start getting passed, piety laws on how to act and how to be. Also some laws like in Geneva, if I remember right, you had to have, I remember this from seminary, Calvin pushed for railings on the rooftops because like kids were falling off. So how do we resolve that and care for one another in a community, right? We put railings up there. These things started happening. So there's all kinds of laws that began occurring that said to do it in, to live this faith in a pious, correct way. And there were some extensive laws. You couldn't act out of hand very much. And so once again, we have these top-down things. Geneva becomes a central place of training for these pastors who are coming in learning this understanding of the Protestant faith. It ends up in England through this. It ends up all over the place because of this. In each place you go, it changes a little bit, right? So when it gets to England, and this is the whole Anglican thing, and Henry VIII wants to divorce his wife and marry, what's her name? The one with the normal name? Whatever her name is. Yeah, her.
He had so many of them. How do we keep
them? Catherine. England, yeah. And wants to marry but can't because, you know, the Pope won't give him a... And so he starts his own thing, which is basically Catholicism, but not. Is all
but
it was.
But the king can get a divorce.
But now he gets a divorce, right. And there's a little few other changes. But there's a group there that says you didn't go far enough. These are the Puritans. And they start pushing for heavy reform. Get rid of everything. No more glass in the pretty glass in the places. Everything is scripture-based. No acting out. Everything has got to be letter of the law, pious, righteous. This was the... As all of this stuff happens in Europe, we have persecutions going on of different groups. And before it's over with, you get a group, several groups of those that start heading across the water because that's better than not. And through that, and I'm trying to remember where they all are, yeah, you have an Anglican group that ends up in Virginia. You have a Puritan group that ends up in Massachusetts. You have a Dutch Reformed group that ends up in the New Netherland at the time. And the Quakers end up in Pennsylvania. So you have these different groups that sort of start popping in across the across the East Coast. And in the process, it's all about the conversion, it starts being about the conversion of people, of individuals, your story, because now the choice is, which one do you go to? They're so far now removed from the powers of the continent that they become separate entities that are all existing. And so some are very pious, some aren't. And the Methodists come over with a very different view on how to do this whole thing. The Quakers are sure not doing it like some of the other movements. You have some that are very tied into serving in the community, like the Presbyterians, and who will serve on governments and serve in councils and serve all kinds of stuff. And then you have the Anabaptists, the Quakers, the Mennonites, and those who will serve nothing of those, will do absolutely no a pledge to anything except to God, won't serve in the military, won't do anything. And you have all of these existing in the same place, and all of them saying, we got the right one, come join us. It becomes kind of a competition away from the continent. How big a difference is that than an 800 Charlemagne putting the crown on a king and saying, we ordain kings? Huge difference. Thoughts? Socioeconomic factors, printing factors, middle class. People now can read. They're allowed to ask questions in Bible study, given in local language. We now have an international reach. There's evidence of Christianity all over the world by this point. All of them incredibly different, and all of it exactly different than surely the Jesus stage, and surely even 1400, as different as can be. And my argument in all this is that this version of the faith that we exist in, this culture version, could not be more culturally influenced, is pretty new in the grand scheme of religion. If we look at it from the Western individual, tell me about your conversion story, your understanding of the faith, what else? The Protestant work ethic, work hard, do your part, be a member of the community in the church. Right? Get in line. Yeah, I told someone the other day, I think a message, I got a picture from Lou that was somebody, there was a table somebody sitting at, and he goes, some of y'all are sitting at tables that were intended for flipping. And I was like, ooh, yes, Lord. Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking that from my understanding of the different groups that came over, the Amish still are very isolated to themselves. There's not too many Puritans left, I don't think, that have been integrated into the rest of the... Isn't there? Are there?
My faith skipped the Puritan Revolution. I don't know that it did everywhere else.
You don't hear of them very often.
Yes,
I don't. But
became the Pentecostal evangelical movement.
Really? Oh, you learn something new every day.
Somewhat, not completely, but that becomes. You have these movements that develop out of, and the Puritan movement, the Piety movement. You can often see some of those traditions, but elsewhere as well.
Well, I just was wondering about how it did spread, you know, because like it really is amazing how some of them stayed together and some of them did incorporate more and more and more.
Yeah, I think it was the basis of how they started. You know, if you're talking about Presbyterianism, which in Geneva and then, and, you know, when at the time when you had the Irish come through Scotland and exist there in Scotland for a while. I mean, Scotland come through Ireland. And you had the Scotch-Irish come and they settle, which became this area in many ways. They come, they're very independent. Like they are very, very independent people. And when they came in, they come into an area, they integrate into the area, they have their faith, but they're gonna serve on a city council. They're gonna do this, they're gonna do that. And how can I live my faith out in the culture, in the community, right? Where you have some who say that the very idea, this is kind of where we went at the beginning, the very idea of living in culture is a temptation away from who I was called to be. So that faith ends up many times putting some distance between our participation in maybe technology, maybe, you know, whatever, maybe social standards, whatever they are. And so by the very nature of their form, they begin doing that. The challenge is those don't sell very well. What sells well is come on Sunday mornings and live Monday through Saturday as best you can, but you're forgiven. Sells pretty good.
Yeah.
Right?
Because living is hard.
It's very difficult. That's what I do. I mean, like between now and Sunday, I'm going to live as good as I can, but I make no promises. But I try to fill myself up, and I'm not dogging it. It's an easy sell because there's something good about it.
Right.
Necessarily required all the commitment you need, but that's why we're looking back at, you know, Dominic and Assisi, Francis and some of those to recognize that maybe there's other things to it too. but again, now don't think that this is just like a climb in America. You have to have two pretty big awakenings to get through this. There was a 1700 first one and then the early 1800s second great awakening. And because, I mean, morally and faith-wise, wasn't a whole lot of times, you know. So we act like
this is the first time in history where we couldn't have Christians run around.
It's okay. But yeah, and we're gonna talk about that next week, is how kind of it started existing in here. And you start having all the splits and things because we were allowed to have the opinion we wanted to have. Like, you can have that opinion, have at it. Let's have a larger conversation about what it means to live right in this world. And that's the other thing that this has developed out of, the humanism hit at this time. What's it mean to be human? And treat people with humanness became huge in this time too. Doggone humanists ruining everything. Can't put other people like that, shameful. Good thoughts. We'll play with that next week too.
Okay.
Existing out from where we are. Yeah. Your thoughts.
Julie looks like she has some thought.
No, I was just thinking right before we left, Gary was saying, I don't know how there's 45,000 denominations, you know, different things. And I said, well, there's three different Cumberland Presbyterian denominations. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yep. You know. And one of them split off basically because of the King James Version by the Bible. The Cumberlands wanted to go to the RSV. Yeah. And they're like, that's just one too far. And they split off. I think y'all know the story about the Upper Cumberland who donated to the camp down in Fayetteville, Crystal Springs, right? Y'all heard this? You know Brent Wills?
I've heard his name.
He's over at Jerusalem Church where...
Sam's.
No.
Janice.
Place.
Same place.
Yeah, a couple of times a month. Yeah, same place. Same church. But anyway, Brent is the head of the camp at Crystal Springs.
That's...
So he gets a call one day, and the guy says, he said, have you heard of the so-and-so 10 or whatever it was? And I don't know. So we were a bunch of guys up at a plant up here in, like, Portland, Tennessee or somewhere up there who won the lottery. They all went in together and bought tickets, and they won. He won a bunch of money. And he goes, they have their camp at Crystal Springs every year, the Upper Cumberland do, which is not like 15 churches maybe in a denomination, but they kind of have a camp. When we have our General Assembly every year, or used to, I think they still do. So he said, y'all's bathhouse is terrible. And he said, I want to build a new one. Tell me how much it is. So he found out, and the guy was ready to build it. And then Brent was like, but you know, we have a mess hall that doesn't have any bathrooms in it. Would you help us out on that too? The guy said, it wasn't going to be pocket change. It's going to be some money. You have to go nowhere. You have to dig and all that kind of stuff. And he said, if you can raise the other half, I'll do one half of it if you can raise the other half. And it was a lot of money. And so Brent went all around the Presbytery. He's going, y'all got to give me money, man. I got to get on the hook. But they did a lot of work up there. It was one of the upper Cumberlands, who donated all that money from
because the Presbytery, they always talk about that camp.
Yep.
So, yeah.
My dad went there.
Oh, really?
My dad went there for that period. So. Yeah, but how is there only 45,000? You know, almost. You know. and to me, it becomes this negotiated understanding of what it means to be a person of faith. That's kind of amazing that we have all these voices that are participating in this larger conversation. And all of them wanting to be reformed and always reforming, even those who... are dragging us back to what they think is. You know. Other thoughts?
I had the random thought that it almost feels like, not devolving is not really the right word, but it's like we're back to a whole bunch of small communities like before the Roman Empire.
Oh, wow.
It was just, you know, all the random cities and collections and churches.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's like we went and organized, and now it's coming back to.
Right. Yeah. You could even go to the point where they had the five bishops and still say that same thing because they were all kind of a little bit decentralized and in kind of conversation with each other. You could even talk about it at that point, still the same thing as that. Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Which is also good, right? We're talking about the challenges of it. But having these conversations, having these places where we can have, because we are individuals, we believe that. We're sure not connected in every single way possible. We're surely not like the ants, that there is no individual, but entirely one colony on the entire world. You know this about ants, right? It's all one colony.
Even supposedly. In the ocean? I mean, I know.
Supposedly it's all one big, that's all I know, is just what I'm told. And it may be its own continents. These massive colonies, that there's no individual. And surely we're not that, and we just think we are. Something else.
I don't know. They're out to get me, though.
That's right. Oh, if ticks are in heaven, I ain't going. Let me just say that right. I ain't going.
Or fire ants.
Or fire ants.
Well, that's what this one is.
I got the mower out today and I ran over probably a dozen fire ant hills.
Stepping tall, were you?
So I hope I didn't anger the bigger hives in the world.
I was reading about something. There were these two different kinds of ants that had this battle, and it took, I'll have to go pull it up. I'm not gonna even say, because I'm afraid of exaggerating, but it was like, I don't know, states apart or counties apart, but it was this massive, like there was this larger, like even the ants are out here fighting these days. I have to go back and look at it too long. How's that? Talk to us about how we are who we are. Do we feel ever as if our faith is not even our own, but a member of a larger body of believers? Is it even possible for us to envision what it would mean for my faith not to be even important to me as much as important to the community?
Can we even think that way, though?
That's what I'm asking. Can we even process what that is like?
I don't know that I could. I mean, I care about other people, but I don't know that I can get into their head and...
I ain't walking barefoot preaching.
Or in their heart to know what they're really going through, too, because it's such an individual thing. I know we shouldn't be talking that way.
No,
but it is.
We are.
Because it's such an individual, it's our stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's who's made us to where, or our situations have made us to who we are right at this point. So can we think of anybody else? I mean, yes, we love one another, we care about one another, that's the community that we live in. But as far as...
But then what Gary just read that Paul wrote.
All things to all people.
That we dig inside ourselves to relate to other people, to find similarities. You know, that I am weak. When you tell me of a struggle, I don't, you know, my first reaction shouldn't be, oh yeah, I've had that. But to me, that's which is...
It's so easy for us to do. Oh God, no, you're saying. No, you don't, shut up!
Exactly. But you can understand.
Well, there's a difference between sympathy and empathy, because sympathy is understanding and feeling sorry for you if you're going through something hard. Empathy is that you have been through that yourself and that you know what it feels like.
What's the step above that?
I don't know.
Is there one above that? So we have sympathy, I feel for your sister. I have empathy, I know that feeling. Is there one above it? Go ahead.
Like you're going through it, I'm going through it, right? Is that, instead of I know what you're going through, I am going through
it. I'm going through it with you.
I will be here, yeah. I'm going through it with you now. Wow, that's interesting.
There's the Jesus level. Here, let me take that pain from you and put it on me.
I'll argue that the level above empathy is love your neighbor as yourself. The idea of love your neighbor as yourself, the idea of I will value your thoughts, your experience, your highs, your lows, your view, your being, I will value that as much as I do my own, is not empathy. It is, oh, we're the same. Oh, so, and that's the whole thing, is you don't judge society by how the best are doing, you judge by how the worst are doing, right? That becomes that sting. Because at that point, I'm making that value of they are as important as I am. Not I will lift them up, but their worth is as much as my worth. Or we could argue more if we wanted to say it that way. How do I then exist in the world where that's true? And that requires more than it requires a, well, St. Francis said it requires me walking around and going kissing lepers. Now, I don't know that the ascetic understanding is the only way to do it. I'm not saying it is, but I think there's a recognition, and I think you're right on it, is how do I exist so that we're connected at the soul? And that becomes the church. That becomes a beacon, that shining light. And that's why you would see the church exploding. And early on, you see other movements doing that when Christianity doesn't, when it had gotten stuck in some other ways. So, my argument, that's Jason what it's worth. Not much. As much as my neighbor. Any other thoughts? I don't know what that word is, though.
I know, I keep wanting to come up with all the prefixes. Put Pathy after it.
Maybe called the way. Foolish. Lord, thank you for this night. Thank you for honest conversation. Thank you for caring enough to ask questions, but also caring enough to try to make sure we find our way into a faith that is an authentic revelation of who you are. That is our hope in this world, and it is what we will carry our cross to if necessary. And God's people said, I hit those exactly the same thing. People do.
I can't impressed. Do that because my body's too sore.
Pretty impressed.
I know. I want to. Well, maybe I should beat myself up. Maybe it will help. Yeah.
Can you imagine? So the indigenous people here and here then were